Before we begin, I would just like to get an idea of how many of you know much about Namibia at all. How many of you know anything about Namibia? Raise your hand.
I know about Zambia.
You know about Zambia. Okay, four or five of you out of, what have we got here, 50 people? I think that points up why it is necessary to discuss this country in Africa. 8 years ago or 10 years ago, I was sitting in New York in a meeting, and Dr. Ed May, who is at the World Community Desk for Lutheran World Ministries, presented to the group of about 40 representatives to the Lutheran Council USA the situation in Namibia. And it was the first time that I was even aware that there was such a place as Namibia, that most of the people there are suffering under tremendous oppression, that half of these people are our Lutheran brothers and sisters. And I just felt from that time that it was part of my responsibility when I felt like I had been somehow touched by the Holy Spirit, that I wanted to talk to other people about this situation. In a sense, I feel strange doing this because I have never been to Namibia. John and I are applying to go to Zimbabwe next year for 3 months. We're not allowed into Namibia at this time. That was our first choice to go. It's very difficult to get a visa there, so I'm going to briefly explain to you some historical background and then try to bring you up to date on what's going on in Namibia and why we as Christians should be concerned. I have a map of Africa here that you probably can't see, but Namibia is down here in the southwest corner of Africa. Do the rest of you want to come over here so you can see this? I hate to keep kind of... Thank you. Formerly, Namibia was known as Southwest Africa. And in order to describe why the situation exists there, I'd like to start by giving you a little bit of history of South Africa itself. Now, up on the board here, I have the bottom part of Africa. This is the South African section. Congo, Angola, Zambia, Zimbabwe, which has just gotten its independence, used to be called what? Rhodesia, okay, Mozambique, Botswana, Namibia, and South Africa. Okay. Way back in, 1497, Vasco da Gama sailed around the Cape of Good Hope in South Africa on his way to India, discovered this lush country. Later on, a Dutch man was shipwrecked there, went back and told the Dutch East India Company that they should try to establish a colony there. They tried, and they did have some Dutch that came down. Pretty soon the English came around, and they tried to start some colonies by sending prisoners there. It kind of worked back and forth between England and the Dutch as to who was going to be there most of the time. But by 1795, there were 15,000 Dutch who lived in South Africa. They are called Afrikaners. When you hear the term Afrikaner, those are white, Caucasian, South Africans who have lived there for many, many years. Then in 1795, the British came again and captured the kind of the Cape of Good Hope, the southern part of South Africa, and started driving the Dutch further and further up into the South African territory itself. There were three types of people at this time, as far as the Dutch were concerned. There were the traders and the innkeepers. Most of these people lived in Cape Town. There were the Boers, or the Boeren. You've heard of the Boer War. The Boerens were Dutch who were wine farmers, or wine, had owned wine vineyards, and had a lot of corn. They were the kind of middle-class farmer. And then there were the Trekboeren. These were farmers who were kind of semi-nomadic, and they were the ones that especially moved deeper into the continent, and they started intermarrying with the blacks, who were called the Hottentots. I've listed some of these words up there, Hottentot, Afrikaner, Boers, Trekboeren, and that became the union of the blacks and the whites, produced the children who are now called colored. There are three different classifications of people in South Africa and in Namibia: the blacks, the coloreds, and the whites. And about 2% of those living in Namibia are Asians, but I'll get to that in a minute. In the 1800s, as the Dutch started moving further and further, the English started taking over more and more of South Africa. And by the 1900s, 1899, there was the Boer War between the Afrikaners and the Dutch or the English people. So the English and the Dutch had a 3-year war, which is called the Boer War, and the result of that formed the Union of South Africa as we know it today. All right, that's a little bit of history about how the Dutch and the English got to South Africa. Now, Namibia. If I say Namibia or Southwest Africa, I'm meaning the same thing. It was not until 1960s that the country changed its name and became known as Namibia. It was being settled by German colonists, and by the year 1884, the German flag was flying over the country of Southwest Africa, flying over the country of Namibia. And after World War I, South Africa was, as you remember, the Germans lost that war, and the League of Nations gave South Africa 5 provinces or areas to kind of be in control of. They were given a mandate to govern these provinces in the best interests of the people of those countries. And Namibia, Southwest Africa, was one of those 5 areas that was given under the control of the South African government. Now let me tell you a little bit about the country of Namibia itself. It's 90 miles. Here's Namibia over here. South Africa is on the southern part. It's 900 miles from the north to the south. It's about the size of the state of Montana. It has about 1.5 million people. 82% are black or colored. 16% are white. And 2% are Asian. So this is a country the size of the state of Montana. As you look at that map that I've put up there, you'll notice that there are small little areas that are blocked off with black. These are called Bantustans. Bantu means black, and they are literally reservations. What has happened since 1945 is that South Africa has put the blacks on these Bantustans. So about 82% of the people live on 12% of the land, something like that. You'll notice that they got none of the seashore. This is virtually all desert. It's called the Namib Desert. By the way, they chose the name Namibia because it means a shield. That's what the word means in their language. And they felt that they needed a shield from the white oppressors, the South African government, who are in their country illegally. South Africa moved most of them into areas like this. Outside of Windhoek, which is the capital, there is kind of a little reservation. All of the people that live here work in the capital city. You're not allowed to live in any of this white area or be there without a passbook. This is called the police zone. And on most maps, there is a little red line across here, so it's also called the red line zone. The police zone, or south of the red line, no one is allowed to be if you're black. So they got none of the seashore. Walvis Bay is the only port in Namibia. And South Africa will probably hold on to Walvis Bay until they're, well, it's going to be an eternity, I think, before South Africa is willing to give up Walvis Bay. That's going to be one of the continuing fights. In order to come into the white area, you need a 96-page passbook that has everything from your name and your dental record to the fact that to whom you were married and what you're doing out of there. Damara land, Harara land over here is 4/5 desert. There's no possible way those people can make a living. They have to come out of the area to work. Most of them work, many of them anyway, in a mine called the Tsumi Mine. It's just about in this area. It is the largest copper mine in South Africa, or in Namibia. It is owned by 2 American companies, the American Metal Climax Company and the Newmont Mining Company. In order to work in this mine, you must be away from your family for 6 months. It's called a labor contract. You're not allowed to go back and visit your family at all. The men live in huge dormitories on little pads. They're given food with a shovel, literally. There are some pictures that I have up here of the men who work in the mines. You're classified A, B, and C according to your strength. You make something like 70 cents a day. Any white worker makes 10 to 12 times more than you do. No black workers are allowed to be in a position of authority over the white workers. If you're married, if you're from Ovamboland, where there are 350,000 blacks who live in Ovamboland, Bantustan, and of these, over 60% are Lutheran. That's where the strongest Lutheran work is, in Ovamboland. But if a man from Ovamboland marries a woman from Herero Land, they are not allowed to live together. She must live here, he must live there. You cannot even go into one of the other reservations without a passbook. The South African government is doing everything that they can to make sure that the tribes are kept separated, to foster hostility between the different groups, to make sure that there's no way that they can band together and be unified. However, this is not happening. The health care for the blacks is atrocious. There is one doctor for every 45,000. No, let me get this straight. It's one doctor for every 44,000 black people. As far as the whites are concerned, it's the highest doctor-patient ratio in the world. It's one person for every 455 doctors. Half of all the black babies die before they're 5 years old in Namibia. 55,000 people die each year from tuberculosis, for which we now have a cure. Education is free for whites and mandatory, so about 97% of all white children in Namibia go to school. For blacks, it is not mandatory, and there is a fee that they must pay. And most of them are living in very subsistence levels, near starvation, and of course have no money to send their children to school. So about 9% of the black children in Namibia are educated, which I think says something about when and if, I won't say if, I'll say when Namibia gets its independence from South Africa, there will be very few leaders who are trained to take over. And right now in Zimbabwe and Zambia, there are a couple of hundred Namibian refugees who are being trained by the presidents or by these countries. Kenneth Kaunda in Zambia and Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe are both trying to educate, help to educate Namibian refugees. Because as our Lutheran bishop said, when we are independent, we're not going to have any resources left in our country because you have been taking them out, and we're not going to have any leadership because there's no way at this point that we can educate any of our people. If you're a black, you live under constant fear of the Terrorism Act. This is done at, according, well, it's called the Suppression of Communism Act. And anybody that speaks against the South African government or writes against them is arrested under the Terrorist Act, and they can be put in prison without their families ever knowing where they are, held in solitary confinement for up to 190 days. They can be banned, B-A-N-N-E-D, meaning that if they have written or spoken against the government there, they are not allowed to meet with more than two or three people at one time, cannot do any more writing. Many of our Lutheran clergymen over there have been banned. Manos Buthelezi, who was in the United States during the 70s, was also banned when he went back to South Africa. So all of these things kind of, I hope, give you a picture of what it means to live under the apartheid system. That's what this is. It's a legal way to separate blacks and whites for the convenience and the, what's the word I'm trying to say, of the whites, for the, to make sure that they are always on top, for the benefit of the whites. It is a very, one of the most violent systems in the world. In fact, a spokesman at the United Nations recently said, since the beginning of time, it is one of the most violent, oppressive systems, and certainly in the contemporary world, to have this going on. The United Nations has been doing everything that they can, not everything, but a lot, to try to relieve this situation. In 1945, the League of Nations became the United Nations. And the United Nations asked South Africa to give the control of Southwest Africa back to its people. And South Africa said, no, we really like it over here. It has an immensely wealthy Well, there are copper mines, there are gold mines, there are diamond mines. Some of the most fabulous diamond mines in the world are in Southwest Africa. None of them, of course, on the Bantustans. They're all in the white area. Some of the very rich, fertile country where they graze sheep, the Karakul furs, which our women in vogue wear. It's the fur of the fetus of these sheep, and the farmers refuse to even give the carcass to the Namibians to eat. They're burned or fed to their cattle. In 1961, the case was brought before the International Court of Justice, and they sat on the case for 5 years and for some legal technicalities finally threw it out. But in 1966, the UN Security Council and the General Assembly voted to terminate South Africa's mandate over Namibia. They just said, you're in there illegally, get out. We insist. All of the nations in the world except South Africa voted unanimously that South Africa was in Namibia illegally, and they better pick up their marbles and get out of there right away. But there was no teeth in the resolution, and it's easy to pass a resolution. I will say that President Carter and Andrew Young, 10 years later, in 1976, when a resolution was again passed because nothing had been done, no one was putting any economic sanctions or any political pressure on South Africa. So 10 years later, finally, another resolution was passed, Resolution 385, insisting that South Africa again withdraw or still get out of there and that free elections be allowed to be held. President Carter worked very, very hard on Congress to get them to put some teeth behind this resolution. Andrew Young did an awful lot also, because Lutheran World Ministries and Lutheran people throughout the United States did an awful lot of ground, grassroots work to get letters and communications. And Senator Mondale was visited by many people who really, I think our Lutheran Church, we can be very proud of the role that they played. But Congress refused to put any teeth into the resolution either. They were afraid, I think that was an election year, 76, yes it was, to say we want economic sanctions on South Africa or we're going to put political pressure. So here it has been since end of World War II that these people have suffered under the apartheid system. And again, I remind you that most of the blacks are Lutheran or Episcopalian, and they are our Lutheran brothers and sisters. In 1978, South Africa finally agreed that there should be a free election. Free election. The blacks, of course, are not allowed to vote in Namibia, or had not been up to this time. They finally said, all right, the blacks may vote, but these are the candidates. And they put up the candidates, some white, some black, but all of the black ones were puppets of the South African government, who were really despised by the rest of the blacks in Namibia. And as a protest against this false kind of election, only 5% of the black Namibians turned out to vote. And after that, the United Nations in 1979 declared that this was an illegal election and that it had no ground whatsoever, no basis for being termed a legal election in South Africa. On May 4th in 1978, on Ascension Day, right after South Africa announced its plans to have a free election, they bombed and strafed one of the large refugee camps right north of Namibia into Angola. It was one of the camps that the Lutheran World Federation had helped to establish. I think this is true. If any of you know differently, please correct me, because as I said, I haven't been there. It's just my reading and my interests that I've, and I'm sure I'm going to be making some mistakes. Is that right, Chuck? Okay. As they bombed the refugee camp, they killed 750 women and children. And there are pictures that Paul Wee had, who's executive director of Lutheran World Ministries, when he was here last winter, showing huge graves of women and children. And I suppose many of them from Ovamboland, many of them Lutherans, well, whether they were Lutheran or not, the fact remains that this was an act of terrorism and violence. After that, they paratrooped 500 South African troops out of the plains. They surrounded the refugee camps and continued to burn all the buildings and shoot anybody that tried to escape. As I was out of the village last week, I listened to a news broadcast on Castro and what he was doing. If you remember, the Cubans have troops in Angola who are fighting Well, let me back up. It seems to me that, as I heard on television and as I read in our paper, anybody that is a guerrilla, for instance, in South or in Namibia, is called a Marxist terrorist. The Lutheran Namibians, our Bishop Cleopas Domeini over there, doesn't call them guerrilla terrorists or Marxist terrorists. He calls them freedom fighters. And I think we have a very biased kind of way to look at this. And I think we have to be very careful as we look in Latin America and South America as to what we label these people. And after John's session this morning, those I wasn't here, but I assume he's, I've heard him do it before, I think we have to realize that one of the biggest theological debates going on in Southwest Africa right now, in Namibia and in Latin and South America, is there such a thing as a just revolution? Can we, at certain times in our lives, be violent? We have lived under this oppression. Everybody in the world is looking at us. The United Nations has declared that South Africa has to get out, and yet nothing is happening. How long can we suffer? And up until the past 2 years, our bishop, who was then Bishop Awala, Leonard Awala, was saying, "My people, be nonviolent. Jesus calls us to nonviolence." There maybe is a time when these people are going to say, as they are now, through the organization SWAPO, which you've probably read about in the paper, Southwest People's African People's Organization. Southwest African People's Organization is called SWAPO. That's, again, the leadership is basically Lutheran and basically from Ovamboland, the Bantustan where 350,000 blacks live. I don't think we can criticize them if they do decide to become violent and take up arms. I don't think we can say that's what God would have them do. But I think, as they are probably saying, we know this is wrong and we confess it as we do it, but it's the only way that we can see. I would have a very difficult time living in that kind of a situation and making any judgment. And I find myself sitting over here in the safe confines of Martin Ridge and the mountains saying, I hope they are not violent, because so far it has been a nonviolent protest. But I don't think that I will ever judge. I hope I don't, because I don't live there and I don't understand what these people are going through. In September of last year, the United Nations passed another resolution, Resolution 435. They're very good at passing resolutions. They keep doing it because we keep putting pressure on them. Our letters do make a difference. And this resolution called for the end of all hostilities, free elections, not like the kind that had been held in 1978, the release of all political prisoners, and the restriction of South African troops in Namibia. South Africa now has 60,000 troops in Namibia, and this last month they have declared martial law on all of the country. 80% of Namibia is now under martial law. And what was most frightening to me was 2 weeks ago from Ed May, I got, this is an alarming whisper about the death squad, code name Kwavoit, which means crowbar in Afrikaner. This is from the Windhoek Observer, the main newspaper in the capital of Namibia. And it tells about the fact that for 1 year there has been a death squad of South African thugs, they call them, and I'm very surprised this is in the official Windhoek paper, which is controlled by the South African government. It lists 90 people who are on the hit list, and at the top of the list is our Lutheran Bishop Cleopas Domeini from the Ovambo Kavambo Lutheran Church. They are systematically trying to eliminate all of the leaders who are speaking out against the South African government. And along with Cleopas Domeini, there are four other Lutheran pastors listed, plus a Seventh-day Adventist pastor. We have a book in the library called Namibia by Colin Winter, who was an Episcopalian bishop who was exiled in 1978. And there are also a list of many black business people who have been active in SWAPO. And I thought this was very frightening to find out that our Lutheran bishop is the first enemy of South African's government. And yet, Cleopas Domeini, our bishop, said he thinks that the hand of God was working even as it was published in the paper, because since it was published in the first part of, June 7th, there has not been one more assassination. And up to that point, about every week, someone was killed. And evidence was left, that it was SWAPO that was doing it, which is rather ridiculous because many of the people listed here are SWAPO members, which is why they're on the hit list. But the South African government has been systematically eliminating these people. But since it was published, Bishop Dumeni feels that maybe the killing will stop, and we certainly hope and pray that this is true. Now, I think there are some things that we can do. I think one of the main things that we can do is to educate ourselves about what is going on in Namibia. Namibians should be daily in our prayers. So should the people, the white people, the Afrikaners, the English in South Africa. Ethiopia needs our prayers. Last year, we wrote a lot of letters from Holden Village to Cleopas Dumeni, the bishop of the Ovambo Kavambo Lutheran Church in Namibia. We also wrote to the leaders in Ethiopia. That has nothing to do with Namibia, but I'm just thinking. When Paul Wee went over to those countries, he sent us a tape back and said, when I walked into the office of the bishop in Ethiopia and he pulled out of his drawer a whole stack of letters of support from Holden Village, do you know anything about Holden Village? He said, you can't imagine what that meant to the people of my church to know that the people in your country and of your Lutheran churches were praying for us. And the same way with Leonard Awala, who was the former bishop of Ovambo Kavambo Lutheran Church, and Cleopas Dumeni. He said to Paul, you just can't imagine what this does for us, to know that we're not alone, that people understand the struggle and that they are praying for us. So I would encourage you to take the word back to your congregations and that you pray for our brothers and sisters in Namibia. Praying and educating ourselves, I think most of our inactivity and our ineptness is that we simply aren't aware. And we kind of use that as an excuse. Well, I don't really know much about it, and I'm too busy to find out, and therefore it just kind of slips away. I do think this is an important issue because there's not much time left. And the other thing we can do is write letters. We need to write to Jimmy Carter to say, please, President Carter, continue to put pressure, economic sanctions, and political pressure on the government of South Africa. He knows about the situation. I'm sure in an election year he needs a lot of push and support to say, keep at it, don't stop now, we're getting our foot in the door, please continue your efforts. And thank you. Write to Donald McHenry, the ambassador of the United Nations. He's in a very good position to continue to push through the United Nations. I've got all the addresses up here if any of you want addresses. I hope you write to your congressperson and your senator about this. Explain why you're concerned and ask them to continue to do whatever they can to put economic sanctions on South African government. You can write to Bishop Cleopas Dumeni from the Ovambo Kavambo Lutheran Church. I love to say that word, Ovambo Kavambo Lutheran Church. It sounds great. And tell him that we are supporting him. We're doing what we can. We're writing letters. We're informing people. We're praying for him. And that we pray God's protection for his life and for the work of his people. Prime Minister Botha, is that how you pronounce it? Botha, B-O-T-H-A-E-A, the Prime Minister of South Africa, also needs our prayers and our letters. If he knows that a lot of people in the United States, little people like you and me who don't have a position but who are informed and know what South Africa is doing, I can't help but think that this will also put the pressure on them. For you that have investments, this is always a problem. The Lutheran Church in America just voted at their convention not to disinvest in South Africa. Chase Manhattan Bank and First National Bank, Citibank of New York, all have big investments in Namibia. Those of you that carry Visa cards, that's City National Bank of New York, Citibank of New York. Del Monte Products, Ford and Chrysler, Gulf, Texaco, and a lot of other oil companies control 44% of the petroleum in South Africa. 80% of the copper is mined in the Tsumi mine that is owned by American companies. You need about 51% of stockholders' votes to change policy. And I doubt that any of us are going to have that much clout. Even our churches and the University of Michigan and some of the big universities that are pulling their investments or refusing to do business in banks that have investments in South Africa. That's something specific that can be done, but it's a very complicated, complex problem.
I know if you're from Seattle, at the end of this month or the first part of October, there's going to be a big push to have all the Christians in Seattle who have, through their churches, have heard of this, to pull their money out of SeaTac, not SeaTac, Seattle First Bank. SeaTac is an airport. Because Seattle First does a lot of business in South Africa. Now, you know, that's, again, I think would have a lot of, when you pull your money out of a bank and write a letter and say why you are, you can't imagine what that does to the top guys in the head office. Even one person doing that, they value you as your customer, and you will hear immediately back from them. You will have a nice letter from the president thanking you for why you're doing it, sorry that you are, and yes, we'll look into this kind of thing. Maybe he throws your letter in the waste paper basket after that. But if enough people do it, I just can't help but believe that that doesn't get them thinking and re-examining again what they're about. I want to read you from Isaiah 58, which I think is very apropos. If you need a reason to kind of get active in the whole problem of Namibia. Isaiah is talking about the fact that a lot of us are very religious people. We go to church regularly, we fast, a lot of fasting is done, and we put ashes, or he's talking to the people, they put ashes on their head and do good things and sing hymns and say prayers. But then God says through Isaiah, "Is not this the fast that I choose, to loose the bonds of wickedness and to undo the thongs of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free and to break every yoke? Is it not to share your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into your house? And when you see the naked, to cover him and not to hide yourself from your own flesh? Then shall your light break forth like the dawn, and your healing shall spring up speedily." I like the way Isaiah ties in our direct actions with our own health. "And your righteousness shall go before you, and the glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard. And then you shall call, and the Lord will answer. And you will cry, and he will say, 'Here I am.' If you take away from the midst of you the yoke and the pointing of your finger and speaking wickedness, if you pour yourself out for the hungry and satisfy the desire of the afflicted, then shall your light rise in the darkness, and your gloom shall be as noonday, and the Lord will guide you continually and satisfy every desire with good things, and he will make your bones strong, and you shall be like a watered garden, like a spring of water whose waters fail not. And your ancient ruins shall be rebuilt, and you shall raise up the foundations of many generations, and you shall be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of streets to dwell in." Before I let you ask your questions or speak, I just want to point out a few more things here. There are three churches, Lutheran churches, in Namibia. Now there are really just two. The Evangelical Lutheran Church of the Evangelical Lutheran Ovambo Kavambo Church, and the Evangelical Lutheran. This is the one that's based in Windhoek, in that area. Lucas de Vries is the bishop. I'm sorry, I've forgotten what this stands for. They just merged to form the UELCSWA. And if you think ALC and LCA and AELC is hard to say, the United Evangelical Lutheran Church of Southwest Africa. The other church is the German Lutheran Church. If you remember, I said by 1884 the German flag was flying over Namibia, and the German missionaries were some of the first ones to be there. Also the Finnish missionaries came, and the Swedish missionaries. The German Lutheran Church is having a struggle. I wouldn't say they're a conservative group, but the word is that when their confirmands are received into the church, they're given a picture of Adolf Hitler. Now that was true in the past, and I'm not sure that right in 1980 that is true, but they looked at Hitler as a person who had brought a lot of social welfare into Germany, who was something like FDR in this country. We're not aware, I guess, of what was going on. The German Lutheran Church is all white. They do not feel at this point that they can, without probably being hassled and everything else that goes on, associate with their black brothers and sisters. So they have not been of much help, it's my understanding. And I've read a letter from a woman Lutheran pastor, a German woman, who said, you know, we understand what has to be done. It's just very, very tough. It's our whole lifestyle. You know, we have lived under this segregated apartheid system, never associating with blacks. I mean, up until 2 years ago, you weren't even allowed to sit on a park bench that said whites only if you were black. All the restroom facilities are segregated. There's an article in the Windhoek paper about some private school that brought black and white children, this was a church school that was integrated, into the library, and they said, we will accept the white children, but we certainly could not let the black children come in and take out a book of the library, out of the library, because if we did, they might bring their parents in next, and then what would that mean to the whole culture and society? So it's still that kind of mindset. And as hard for us as it is for us in this country to get over our very deep-rooted prejudices, and they come out as you visit with people at Holden and elsewhere, we still have a lot of basic racial prejudices within all of us. And I'm sure if we lived in Namibia and were a member of the German Lutheran Church, it again would be very, very difficult to get over these feelings. I don't think there's any doubt that Jesus calls us to something different than this. But I'm just telling you that it is, again, very hard for us to sit here and judge what those people are doing. But the Lutheran churches are very strong in Namibia, and Cleophas Demeny, who has been in this country, is a very beautiful, gentle, wise man, and I think we should be very grateful that he is the bishop over there. Now, maybe I can answer some questions. Maybe with Chuck helping, together we can.
I doubt that's true today.
It's not true in Germany. It's true in Namibia.
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
Well, because they're doing everything they can to erase the memory of Hitler.
Yeah. That's good to know. Yes, she said she just got back from a tour of West Germany, and the churches there do not give pictures of Hitler to their confirmants. I didn't mean to imply that. I meant in Namibia. They're doing everything that they can in West Germany, she said, to erase the memory of Hitler and to educate. The Bantustans are the reservation. A Bantu is a black, and that's all of those 10 little reservations where the blacks are forced to live. Yes, ma'am. The Cuban soldiers were in Angola, were sent over there to help fight. Well, they are Marxists. Chuck, can you explain that a little bit better? The CIA helped the South African government last year to go through Namibia and to establish a no man's land for 6 miles wide.
Right, at the top of Ovamboland, because see,
Namibia is the last stronghold as far as South Africa is concerned. All of these countries have gotten their independence, and they're very much afraid that the Marxist regime is going to come down and encroach in South Africa. And so this is the last kind of pushing everybody back. That's why they want their troops here. Robert Mugabe, who is a fine Christian man, who is president of Zimbabwe, yes, he's a Marxist, or at least, but he is a Christian. I think as soon as we label someone Marxist, we immediately think of atheistic communism, and I'm not sure that's fair to do. Sometimes we put labels on people, and nothing shows that Robert Mugabe is going to do anything in Zimbabwe except be a very fine Christian leader. Kenneth Kaunda is a Methodist bishop. The same thing was said of him. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't atheistic Marxists, because there are. But, Chuck, go on. I interrupted what you were going to say.
Well, the Cubans originally came to Angola, and Angola was fighting for independence from Portugal. Portugal was a Portuguese colony for hundreds of years, and there were several factions fighting within Angola for liberation from Portugal. One of them was finally triumphed, was the Marxist oriented group. We and China and some other countries supported another group, which lost. Well, that civil war in Angola, that tension between factions within Angola, of the liberated Angola, continued. And Cuba has kept troops in there, I guess, supporting the victorious group.
But I guess what I was saying about that was that they were immediately labeled Marxist terrorists. To the Angolan people, they were considered freedom fighters. the same thing about SWAPO. That is an underground guerrilla organization in Namibia made up of blacks, and most of whom are Lutheran. It is the officially recognized governing group by the United Nations. SWAPO is officially recognized as the group with whom you do business, and that is the leadership of Namibia, and not the West African or the South African government. So I guess I was referring to the fact that though they were fighting for their freedom in Angola using Cuban troops, you know, we would say they're Marxist terrorists, and those people would say they weren't. Yes.
Part of the problem is very simply the refusal of the West to support strongly enough SWAPO pushes SWAPO more toward the Eastern Order, and they have to get their support somewhere. Not only guns, but also other kinds of support. Much of the support from the West has come from the Churches, led by the Lutherans, led by the Lutheran World Federation. The International Association of Lutheran Churches has been very supportive of SWAPO. But the more the Western countries and Western people pull away from SWAPO, saying, well, they're just a bunch of Marxists, the more that pushes them, because they have no other alternative, into the arms of the Soviets, or the Soviets and the Cubans. So some of what we get, I think, in those countries, we deserve. If they become dependent on the Marxist, the socialist governments of the world, it's because they didn't get help from the West.
The same thing is happening in Zimbabwe right now. We promised a huge amount of money, well, not a huge amount, but I forget how many millions of dollars, to Zimbabwe to help rebuild the country after the war there. And we have reneged on that, only given them a very small amount, and they are looking elsewhere to, as Chuck said, the Eastern Bloc of nations for some help, because they do need money to help rebuild. They're a very, very poor country. And Paul, we again said, one thing we as Christians could do would be to write to the president and to our Congress people and say, look, we made a promise to help these people. We've not done it. And if they do fall away from the Western influence, you know, again, there is a reason why they do this.
And the Dutch side with the color, while the English keep the color for the blacks,
right? Mm-hmm.
So it's a problem that's not easily dealt with.
Cry the Beloved Country by Alan Payton would be a good one to read, and James Michener's what, Star of what?
Star of Freedom.
Star of Freedom, okay. And talking about the Irish situation, if you've not read the book Trinity, to get a background for why the Protestants and Catholics are fighting is an excellent way to get your history in a marvelous novel form. Yeah. Well, and the same way with us in the United States. You know, the civil rights movement was a long time in coming, and it's still, that feeling is there, but I hope we've made some progress. Anybody else have questions? Not right now, no. Ed May always asks the question when people say that, you know, is it better to live under the apartheid system of the South African government or under a Marxist government? You know, I don't think Christianity needs to be equated with capitalism, and I guess we do that a lot of times, but that's a hard question. And I think was it the World Council of Churches that was supporting some guerrilla activities in some of the African countries too? People got very upset. That was a big debate, and it's going to be a big debate at the ALC convention in October. If any of you are going, any of you delegates to the ALC convention here? Too bad, because I'd sure like to talk to you. I have a hard time thinking that we want to keep our investments as a church in South Africa, knowing that it would take 51% of the vote to change any policy. She's asking if we shouldn't encourage our representatives and our government to strengthen the United Nations so it does have more teeth. The United Nations is only as good as the countries that back it up. So I think we have to insist that Congress back up. I mean, the United Nations has put some very strong resolutions here. They've done just about everything they can do until the individual countries that vote for the resolution say, I'm voting for resolution 485 or whatever it was, 43. And this is how I'm going to back it up. You know, it's like a mother saying, if you stay out late one more time, I'm not going to let you do this or that, and then not following through, you know, and the kid continues to do it and do it and do it. So what good does the mother saying anything have to do unless she puts some discipline and some teeth behind it? I really think, maybe I'm wrong, but I think the United Nations has done what it can, and now it needs the backing of the members of the United Nations who voted to continue sanctions. Well, maybe that's true, too. I just am not familiar enough with it to... Chuck?
I want to mention a connection with missionary personnel here in Namibia. Some of you may know John Bronley. He's an ALC pastor who was, I think, in Madagascar, and then came to serve the parish in Montana. And then was to go to Namibia as an ALC person on the faculty there, the seminary. And he waited around for 2 years for a visa to be approved by the South African government. There is no independent government in Namibia, so the South African government always has to approve the entry of international personnel. And they finally replied and they said no, and they gave no reason. And they do that regularly. They don't have to give a reason why they declined to give entry permission. So John is now at Golden Valley Lutheran College in Minneapolis as dean of the faculty. But he really wanted to go to Namibia and teach in the seminary there, and he was not permitted. No personnel from Western countries, at least from the United States, I think it's true of Finland and Germany too, have been given entry permission to Namibia in recent years because apparently the South African government suspects that they will be supportive of the change. And so they just don't want that.
Can you imagine living in a situation where everybody is afraid of everybody else? I mean, talk about perfect love casting out fear. To me, that is a beautiful example of what could happen if we start loving one another. If you were a Namibian, black or white, always being afraid that you were going to be shot. Paul Wee talks about driving over mined roads and having to jump out of the jeep, and Bishop Cleopas Demeny having a big tank parked right in front of his house with a gun aimed at his house all the time. And just this not knowing who's going to squeal on you and who's a terrorist and who isn't and who's going to inform. And I don't know. It's just very tragic.
You're describing perfectly life in the communist countries. Just what you were saying. You're afraid to talk to anybody. You're afraid to trust people. Because if you open your mouth to say anything, you will find yourself in Siberia.
Mm-hmm.
And the minute that I found out that our church was interested in Namibia, I said, God, stay in Namibia, because if we help them to overthrow the government that's there now, communists will come in and take the government of the country. And they'll be worse off than they are now. As they have to follow, they won't be
well, yeah, but see, I think you could use Zimbabwe or Zambia as examples where that really hasn't happened where people thought it would. I think if it continues, that might be a possibility. But SWAPO right now, I don't know. It's just an opinion.
He's being very quiet because he wants help from the United States. But they will go right ahead with their communist plans. Pretty soon, the former will be a solid communist state. And all the people will not be free.
Yeah, I guess I would disagree with you on that, but I...
Yeah, well,
you wouldn't
wait.
Yes, ma'am.
Communism can't be any worse because the people are suffering in this country right now. The black people, that is. Because if a woman's husband dies there, she can't stay in what's been her home all her life. She's shipped off to where she came from originally. She's never seen that country. It's a barbaric country. She's shipped off there and to live in a hut when she's been living fairly decently, well, not fairly decently, but with a husband that earned a salary. She's shipped off to this strange place. She has nothing to say about it. Is communism that bad? I'm not speaking for communism, don't get me wrong, but what they have now Southern Africa is much worse than communism. For the black people, I'm not saying for white people, but for the black people, it's terrible.
Somebody over here have their hand. Okay, thank you very much for your attention, and I hope you keep the people in your prayers.